Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone who's joining us here on Happy Hour with Dr. T. Each week, we get together with amazing guests for conversations to inspire you and help you to grow. You will be able to find past interviews if you are a podcast member by going to drtenpenny.com and hover over the podcast tab, and you can find it in that area. With that, tonight is a kickoff of another important series with Happy Hour with Dr. T as a special event on Thursday nights. Our Thursday night series are more in-depth, more detailed, and have much more Bible study in them than our Thursday nights, which are mostly conversations with pastors and authors and Christian business people. So what we've done with these special events for the past several years, we've hosted special event series for deeper Bible study on Thursday nights. We've completed several series with Mike Spaulding, authors Doug Woodward, Derek Gilbert, L.A. Marzulli, and they are available at learning4you.org, learning4you.org, my sister educational site. And 100% of those sales proceeds to those amazing four-part courses are available to you for free indefinitely as lifetime access if you are a podcast member. If you want to go back and listen to them and you're not a podcast member, you can purchase them, and then 100% of the sales proceeds go to the authors, to the pastors, as a thank you for their time for putting this together. Tonight is part one of an important four-part series for a new book by returning author and friend, Pastor Doug Van Dorn. Douglas Van Dorn is a pastor with a Master's of Divinity from the Denver Seminary. He has pastored the Reformed Baptist Church in Northern Colorado since 2002. He started with the Reformed Baptist Network and has served on the boards of two associated churches. Doug's book that first caught my attention when we started all of this was a book called Giants, Sons of Gods. After a discussion on Happy Hour, Doug completed a four-part series for us as a Happy Hour intense study on the Giants. And then he completed a 10-year anniversary update of his book, realizing that there was a lot more that he had learned and a lot more he'd uncovered within the last 10 years. As a podcast member, again, you have lifetime access to this series under the podcast section at drtenpenny.com. In his new book, Rings of Revelation, which has just been released in text form, he has created a four-part educational series for Happy Hour. This four-week series will help you to understand how to read the book of Revelation as literature. Then you will understand how John wrote it, its central message, and when you understand how John wrote it with the central message, allows you to make sense of the rest of the deeply mysterious book, especially in the supernatural elements that most of us find strange and sometimes even enigmatic. Week one is called The Rings of Revelation. We're going to look at the ancient form of writing called ring composition and how the movie Star Wars can help us understand the book of Revelation. He will then take a deep look at the literary rings of Revelation and how this helps us understand what John was writing about and pointing us in the right direction for the central teaching of the book. Wow, Doug, thank you so much for coming back and doing another four-part series with us. You know, you did a Happy Hour with us just a few weeks ago, and you mentioned this. It sounded so fascinating. I can hardly wait to hear what you have to say about it. So I'm not going to talk anymore. I'm just going to go ahead and let you get started.
All right. Thanks, Sherry, for having me on again. I love coming on your show, and I love so much the work that you're doing. Yeah, we were talking about this book. I had just put it out really this last month. So even when we talked about it, it wasn't out yet. And it comes from a really 20 years of me teaching on the book of Revelation in our church and actually a couple of different churches. Wanted to write it for a long time. And for whatever reason, I guess the Lord just wanted it to come out at this point. His providence, and we'll see about the timing and what's happening in the world. But I wanted to make this a little bit different kind of a book than what you'll usually hear with Revelation. I didn't want it to be super sensational and kind of reading the newspaper headlines and then figuring out where we are in the book timeline. I wanted to look at it more from a literary point of view, because my take on the way Revelation it should be read is quite different than most of my friends. And ironically, I think we can end up coming to some pretty similar positions, at least kind of at the very end of days, but we won't get that till that to the last of the four-part series. So what I want to look here at is really just how should we go about reading the book of Revelation? It's a question that most people really, they don't even bother to ask it. I think they just assume, well, you just read it like any other book. You know, so if you were to pick up a book of fiction and you start reading it, you wouldn't skip around chapters and read chapter 2 in a fiction book and then chapter 13 and then chapter 25 and go back to chapter 4 or something like that. You would read it chapter by chapter, and you would understand that the author wanted you to read it in a way because each chapter is building on the next chapter to the final conclusion in the last chapter, right? So you just read it linearly. And I think that that's how we read most books, you know, not all books. You might read a car manual, just pick out what you need. But most books that we sit down and read, we read them linearly, and we understand that they're meant to be read consecutively so that each chapter comes after the next comes after the one before it all the way to the end. If you presuppose that way of reading the book of Revelation, you're going to come out with a way of understanding the visions that are in front of you in a very particular way. Okay, so chapter 20 comes chronologically after chapter 19. That's something that we'll get back to at some point with those two chapters especially, because it's kind of the key to understanding the main idea of Revelation and what they call the millennium and where, you know, history timeline is in relation to this 1,000-year reign of Christ that's talked about, that Christians have really disagreed on for 2,000 years. It's because, and I think it's because of the way that people approach the book of Revelation. So that's kind of the setup. Let's talk about another way that you can read the book of Revelation. It's actually the oldest way that's been proposed in church history. We have a fellow named Victorinus Patu over in Slovakia, who said he kind of proposed that when you're reading the bowls and the trumpets, that they may not necessarily follow one after the other, that they might kind of overlap. He was writing in 300 AD. And then our very first entire commentary in church history that we still have to this day by a fellow named Tychonius, which was written about 385 AD, he applied this whole rule to the entire book. So in other words, things may not be happening chronologically. They might be happening more as what I'm going to call cyclically, or in terms of a literary composition, it's been called a ring composition. So this is going to get a little bit heady, Sherry, because people are not used to thinking about how to read books. But if we can get our minds wrapped around this, and I'll do my best to explain it, I think all of a sudden this book will become even more interesting, I think, to people than it already is. So ring composition, I first found out about this actually preaching through the book of Leviticus a few years ago from a literary scholar named Mary Douglas. She was actually an English writer, but she had an interest in biblical literature, specifically the book of Leviticus. And she argued that Leviticus is doing something that most people don't understand. Like when I tell people, when you're reading through your Bible in a year, you know, you get to Genesis and you're like, yeah, flying through Genesis is great stories, half of Exodus. And then you come to the end of Exodus and it's all this kind of law and about the tabernacle. And you're like, well, that kind of gets boring. And then you read Leviticus, and half the people just stop. I can't handle Leviticus. Like, what do you do with this book?
I'll tell you. You know, when I started,
it seems so weird, right?
When I started reading through the book, because I had just decided that this was going to be the year that I was going to read the whole book of the Bible from the beginning to the end.
Uh-huh.
You know, right straight through. And when I got to Leviticus, I called my friend Brad Cummings, and I said, do I really have to read this?
That's exactly right.
Do I really have to read this just to say that I read it? You know, just to say that. And then you read it and it's a lot more interesting than what you think it will be.
It is interesting. Yeah, let me add a layer to why it's interesting. So she argues that the book is actually written to pattern something in the real world. And she uses things like old poems that we have, Greek poems. So there's a poem called The Altar that a fellow wrote. And he wrote it line by line so that the lines end up looking like an altar on the page. So it's a poem about an altar that looks physically like an altar in its poetic textual form. So she's arguing that Leviticus is actually patterned to look like the tabernacle. So the first, I think it's 17 chapters of the book, all take place in the courtyard. All the laws take place in the courtyard. And then from chapters 18 through 24, all the laws take place in the holy place. And then from chapter 25 to 27, all the laws take place in the most holy place. And that's when you come to kind of the end of the book. And then there's actually two warning passages, two stories. There's only two stories. All the rest is law code. And she argues that both of those act as the screens to warn you about what you're approaching and entering. And because both of those stories are death stories, like you did something wrong and you're going to die for it. So in other words, the Leviticus isn't just random laws. It's a book that's written to look like something in the real world. In this case, the tabernacle, which is what the whole book is really focusing on.
Wow.
Yeah. So she says that ring composition is really, really old. The whole idea of it is that you're trying to develop a theme. You start off with an idea, you develop your theme, and then you take your theme to a conclusion. But the conclusion is a ring or a hinge or a hook that comes back to the very first point that you made. Okay, so it really creates a circle, and that's why it's called a ring composition. So when you apply this to Revelation, and she says one other thing that most Westerners find it very difficult to even identify ring compositions. And I think it's because they're not looking for them. They don't understand what they're reading. Like, they might understand that they're seeing repeating themes, but they don't have a comprehension of what that could mean in terms of literary function and why it might be doing that. So when you apply this to Revelation, you can find as many as seven different cycles in the book. So chapters 1 through 3 would be a cycle, chapters 4 through 7, 8 through 11, 12 through 14, 15 and 16, 17 through 19, and 20 through 22. So they create seven cycles. And the idea is that those cycles begin more or less around the first coming of Christ. And then they take you to the second coming, and then they start over. And they take you to the back to the first coming, and then they go to the second coming, back to the first coming, back to the second coming. So in other words, you're not necessarily seeing everything as being consecutively laid out. You're seeing them as repeating themes. And I look at it, I explain it kind of the way that if you were to walk up a castle turret, where the circular part on the corner of the castle, and it has a circular stairway. And when you look from the outside, you'll see it might have 3 or 4 different windows, but they're all vertically lined up. So if you come to one window on the bottom and then you go around the circle and you come up and you come to the second window, you're actually on the same vertical axis as you were before, but you're looking out at the same scene, but you're higher up. You're at a different
vantage point,
a vertical point of looking at it. So you're getting a different view is the idea of it, but you're going in a circle. So you're coming back to the same place that you were before. So what's really interesting about that is that several of these cycles end in a war, and all of these use the very same language of having the nations and the kings gathering or assembling together, and then God is going to throw them into the winepress of his wrath, and there's a lake of fire where they will be thrown, and there's the judgment of God. So if you read those consecutively, then you might think, well, there's 4 different wars that are going to take place. If you read them secularly as a circle or cycles, well, you can come to the conclusion that that's actually describing the same war from 4 different perspectives.
Interesting.
And that's the idea of what a ring composition is trying to get you to understand.
Do a lot of writers write in that way, but they don't really, they do it kind of the way that they just write, or is that something that you're taught like in school, or how does that come about? And did John know that he was intentionally writing in circles like that?
Yeah. Yeah. All great questions. So I'm convinced that the way that we've been taught, at least in our modern education system, is not this way. We're, you know, think about how you look at a book and you say, how do you outline this book? Well, you go point one, point two, point three, point four, point five, and then you end it. So our minds have been trained to think about outlines, and that's the way that they trained us in school. I'm convinced that the ancient mind thought in circles. And one reason is because they were mostly oral cultures. And so when they told their stories, it makes a lot more sense to make your story a circle because it's a lot easier to remember it because you're coming back on the things that you had already talked about. And so, you know, the more I've looked into this, the more I'm convinced that this is just the way that ancient minds thought in general. And then when they went to get training, yeah, they definitely were trained specifically with the idea of how to write ring compositions.
Do you think that ring composition also applies to other books of the Bible? Like I'm thinking like maybe Isaiah and some of the ancient prophets that seem to be kind of heavy. And like you said, we are taught to think in outlines, but we're also trained to think linearly instead of in a circle. So do you think other books kind of, it
absolutely
applies to other books?
Yeah, I can give you just a couple of examples. So one would be the Psalms. So we tend to think Psalms are all just kind of just a random Psalm, read a Psalm, you know, kind of your daily reading. So one example in the Psalms is that Psalm 15 through 24 are all written as a ring composition, or at least they're put together. They're organized as a ring composition so that Psalm 15 is an entrance liturgy. Psalm 24 is an entrance liturgy. And then in between, you have this movement. So Psalm 15 begins with who shall ascend to the holy hill? And then the answer is the person who keeps the Torah. But the next Psalm tells you, but I'm a sinner. But the next Psalm tells you is kind of a prayer for help. Lord, please help me. And then the next Psalm is the Lord is my trust. And then the very center of this, and we'll talk about what I mean by a center in a minute, is actually Psalm 19, which is one of the great Psalms on the Torah, which is what the original psalm in the grouping was asking. Who can ascend the hill? The one who keeps the Torah. So Psalm 19 is the center, tells you about what the Torah is, and then it works its way out in an inverse relationship. So you put your trust in the Lord, and then you come to a couple of messianic psalms where, but God has forsaken me, and then Psalm 23 is, but the Lord is my shepherd. And then the last psalm takes you back to the original question, who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And the answer is, the Lord will ascend the hill of the Lord, and he will take those with him who trust in him.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, you can read them all as individual psalms, but when you understand that they're actually meant to be read together, all of a sudden you have a completely different way of understanding them together.
Absolutely. That's fascinating. Because I think you're right. I think most of the time when we think of Psalms, because there's 150 of them, you read one and two, then three, then four, and you don't think about them as a grouping. That's and then circularly is even an additional level of grouping. That's fascinating.
Yeah, even Psalm 1 and 2 do this. They're the only two Psalms in the Psalter that have a, they don't, in the first book of the Psalter, that don't have a superscription of who wrote them. So most of them say a Psalm of David. Well, Psalm 1 and 2 don't have that, but they begin with the law, and then they end with the law. And at the ending of the law, you have to kiss the son in order to be the one who's accepted by God and become a law keeper. So it actually acts as a kind of an introduction to the entire book of Psalms when you understand that it's not just a collection like of random songs or something, but it's actually a book to be read.
When you started digging into this and studying it and learning about it, and then you went back to read the Bible, because obviously you're a pastor and you study a lot of those things. Did it change the way that you read a good portion of the Bible?
Oh my goodness. It's changed everything about how I read the Bible.
Wow.
And it adds so many layers to it and so much excitement to it, because you start seeing interconnections between, you know, not only chapters, but within a whole book. And then even sometimes within more than one book, which is something that we're really going to talk about here in a minute.
That's great. Well, let's take a good spot to take a little break. We are speaking tonight with a pastor, Doug Van Dorn, and he's talking about his new book, Rings of Revelation. We're talking about ring composition, which I find just fascinating. And once you hear this, you'll probably be like him. You'll go back and you'll start reading your Bible from a completely different perspective. So we're going to take a really quick break. Sit tight. We'll be right back.
Zeolite is a detox spray
We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use, and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant. You can take it when you're nursing. You can give it to little children. You can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out, the heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch with in our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years.
Go to drtenpenny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off.
Well, welcome back, everyone. So Doug Van Dorn is talking about his new book, The Rings of Revelation. We've been talking about ring writing and ring composition. So I just find everything that you said so far, Doug, just really, really inspiring and very interesting. It's like I want to run upstairs and grab my Bible and start reading it and see if I can see some of those patterns.
Oh, good. That's the hope.
That's good.
So I said that in the book, what I did is I decided a friend of mine who's a missionary over in Ireland and teaches languages for a couple of seminaries many years ago showed me something with George Lucas's Star Wars and how it's actually doing the same thing and we don't realize it. And so I decided to use this in the beginning of the book just as an analogy to help people understand that this is actually something that you see in the modern world too, and you may not even recognize it. So here's a quote from George Lucas, because some people will say, well, you're just making things up. You're seeing things. And there's a whole website that's dedicated to basically looking at Star Wars as a ring composition, or another word for it is a chiasm.
Wow.
So this is something that he gives in one of his extra, you know, endings of your Star Wars, you know, CD series or whatever. He talks about it's how this is a musical idea. You have a lyrical refrain and you keep playing it over and over and over again using different instrumentation, different octaves. It changes every time you rehear it. It's the same note played differently. He says, I've tried to use that right from the very beginning when I did Star Wars. Literally, it came out with something I was trying to do with the digital sound that they came out, the THX at that point in time. And then he says, instead of three acts, there was almost like three different movies. But each movie is telling the same story in a different way. I became fascinated with the idea. It's a kind of visual jazz. You go off on a riff on the same idea. You just take a concept and you interpret it differently visually. And there's a lot going on in these movies. I like the idea of cyclical motifs that keep reoccurring over and over and over again. So when you look at how Star Wars came out, you know, in 1977, you had the original Star Wars, A New Hope. But if you look carefully at the very introduction, it will call it Episode 4. And you're like, well, what is that? Episode 4. And then Empire Strikes Back was Episode 5. And then Return of the Jedi was Episode 6. And then Phantom Menace that came out 15 years later was Episode 1. So he actually started with 4 and then goes back to the first 3 at a later time. So that means that when you're looking at the episodes in the order that he wants you to have them, you actually have to look at the second 3 sets first in order to understand as the backstory. So this ends up creating some really weird connections when you go in the order, not of how they came out in, you know, the years, but how they actually were meant to be read. So here's just a couple of them for fun. The Phantom Menace episode is the first movie, Episode 1, that came out as the 4th movie. It talks about two Jedis embarking on a mission to rescue Queen Amidala from the palace. When you go to the last of these movies, that's Return of the Jedi, that came out 15 years before it, you have two droids embarking on a missionary to rescue Han Solo. You go to the Act 2 of the movies and you're on a planet Tatooine, a native named Anakin Skywalker befriends a Jedi and helps him fix the ship. You go to the last movie, you have Rebels. You have, they're on a planet Endor. You have native Ewoks befriend Rebels to help them take the shield generator. Like this stuff, there's parallels, identical parallels going on everywhere in these movies, even from scene to scene. So you'll have like a mom, the mother of Darth Vader as a kid. You have a scene of her from the back and you're looking at him. Well, in the parallel movie, you have the exact same scene, except it's Princess Leia looking at Luke Skywalker from the exact same scene. So he's doing it visually. He's doing it with audio. He's doing it actually with the stories that he's telling. And it's all meant to be working circularly on your brain as a way of understanding the movies. And I actually think that this is why the older Star Wars movies, as opposed to the new garbage that Disney's putting out, actually holds up as not just a good story, but like this is kind of, it's telling timeless truths in timeless ways.
That's really interesting. And I think that all of the older movies are much better movies and made better ways than, like you said, the junk that Disney is putting out now. You know, Disney's taken such a huge fall, and rightfully so. And so it's really great to go back and watch old things. And now when you can put an extra layer of education on top of them instead of just entertainment, that's even better.
Exactly. So that's kind of the way Star Wars works. And it's an exact kind of a parallel to what I'm arguing that Revelation is trying to do. So thinking about the idea that Revelation is a cyclical book, I want to talk about something that's called a chiasm. So a chiasm is a specific form of ring composition. Okay. And people use this actually quite often, and you don't realize that it's actually what they're doing. It's actually got a name for it. So remember when JFK said, ask not what you can do for your, what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Mm-hmm. This is a chiasm. What you can do for your country, what your country can do for you. You hear the repetition, but it's inverted. Or Jesus said this, the first will be last and the last will be first. So what you're doing is you're creating an ABBA pattern so it becomes memorable, so that the two sides of it are playing off of each other. It's very meaningful when you hear either one of those things. Don't ask what you can do for your country, but you flip it and all of a sudden what your country can do, if you flip it and ask what you can do for your country, it's totally inverted in meaning, but you're doing it in a very pithy sort of a way. And people talk about, they talk like that, I think, pretty often, and they don't even recognize that they're doing it. We have those kinds of small chiasms all the time. We do it. Ancients did it. You find them on a verse level all the time in the Bible. It's just a literary device that most people recognize in small sections, but they don't usually take it to a larger level. So the reason it's called a chiasm is because it's coming from the Greek word key, which looks like our letter X. And the word actually literally means a crossing or a reversal of ideas. So in an X, you know, you have two sides coming to a point and then they go back out the way that the X is written. So the point becomes the center of it. So in what I just gave you, you have kind of two centers because it's an ABBA. So the first will be last and the last will be first. In that case, last is the center. But if I added a word there, I can make a different center. So if I said the first will be last, Peter, and the last will be first. Now all of a sudden, Peter becomes the central focus of it. And what he's supposed to be doing is, you know, hearing it. Himself personally. So when you do that, then you have an ABCBA and the C becomes the center part of it.
Hmm.
Think about it like an arrow, a tip of an arrow that as you're working your way out from the extremities of the tip, those are parallel. And then as you come close to the tip, you have a parallel idea and then another one, and then the very center becomes the tip. It becomes the point, the thing that's aiming at the target. Okay. And that's a literary way of getting a focal idea that we might usually put into a conclusion, but you're actually putting it in the middle of your story.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. Kind of reminds me of when we were in grade school where we used to, I'm a little older than you, Doug, but, you know, back in the day when you used to dissect sentences and be adverbs, adjectives, and these little things that hang off of it.
Right.
It's kind of the same sort of thing and sort of dissecting your sentence.
Exactly.
That's great.
So these are very helpful. I mean, I'm coming to learn that there's chiasms in almost every part of our Bible, and they work on a, sometimes on a level of a sentence, like we just had. Sometimes they'll work on a level of a paragraph. Sometimes they'll work on the level of a chapter or half of a chapter. And they can get even bigger and bigger and bigger than that. So what I want to do here is I want to help people understand that Revelation itself is a very large chiasm.
Ooh.
And this will become very important for understanding why we need to learn to read Revelation as a book of literature, okay? So I've talked about how Revelation can be viewed as rings. But I also want to talk about how it can be viewed as a chiasm. So instead of having seven different circular repeating ideas, you can actually read it so that it has one central idea. And this forms something that is so almost incomprehensible that it doesn't seem like it could really even be possible to do. So I got this from a scholar named Warren Gage, who was a professor. He was at Knox Theological Seminary. I think he's retired and he's doing something different from that now, probably working on some of this material. This is what he did his PhD work in when he was working on Revelation. And as we'll talk about in the next episode, he was also doing this with John's Gospel. And what he discovered was that the beginning of Revelation and the very end of Revelation end almost exactly the same. So that in verse 1 of the book, it talks about things that must happen quickly. And then when you come to the very end of the book, Jesus says, "I am coming quickly." Verse 3 of the book, it says, "Hear the words of this prophecy." Well, verse 18, so now we're moving back just two verses from the very end of the book. It says, "Hear the words of the prophecy." So just right there, we have an ABBA, but we're only still at the very tips or the outer extremities of the book. We're just in the very first couple verses of the first chapter and the very last couple of verses of the last chapter. If you go to verse 8 of chapter 1, it talks about the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And then if you go to verse 13 of the last chapter, it talks about the Alpha and the Omega and the beginning and the end. Because we have some time, I can keep doing this for a little bit. Verse 17 of chapter 1, "When I saw this, I fell at his feet." If you go down to verse 8 of the last chapter, "When I heard this, and I saw it, and I fell at his feet."
Oh, wow. So
this just keeps going, Sherry. Verse 19 of chapter 1, "The things which shall soon take place." And verse 6 of chapter 22, "The things which must take place soon."
Wow.
Chapter 2, verse 1, "In the midst of the seven lampstands." And then in chapter 22, verse 2, "In the midst of the street." So now there's a little difference there, the street and the lampstands, and sometimes that's done for to highlight the differences. So they're not always parallel in terms of exact word ideas. Sometimes they can be opposite word ideas. So you might have the first one might say good, and then the next one might say evil as a parallel. as kind of contrasts. In chapter 2, verse 7, you have the tree of life. In chapter 22, verse 2, you have the tree of life. This just keeps going. It goes through chapter 2. It goes through chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, chapter 11, into chapter 12. When what you find is when you come to chapter 12, you end up coming to a very central place that becomes the key or the tip of the arrow or the central idea of the book of Revelation. And then once you get that central idea, then it starts working its way back out in the parallels until you get to the very end that we just discussed. So this is what the very center of the book of Revelation is. It's Revelation 12, 9 through 10. The great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who's called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accusers of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before God. So you have in this two verses, Revelation 12:9 and Revelation 12:10, that are paralleling but also contrasting each other. So the first one has a fourfold name of the evil one, the dragon, the serpent, the devil, and Satan. The second one has a fourfold idea of the power of Christ, salvation, power, kingdom, and authority. The first one has the one who deceives the whole world, and then the second one calls him the accuser. The first one says he's thrown down. The second one says he's thrown down. So that's the central idea of the book of Revelation read as a chiasm. Mm-hmm. Now, we might think the central idea would be the last verse of the book. In one way, it is because it's a conclusion. But in this way of looking at it, this becomes the central focus point. And everything else, if you think of it like a hinge on a door, this is the hinge around which the door is then turning on its axis.
Wow.
So if you look, I'll just fill it out just a little bit more here. If you look at on either side of these two verses, so verse 8, the devils did not prevail. And verse 11, the martyrs overcome them. So that's just one verse off of each one of these. The next verse before that, there's a war in heaven with a dragon. And then the next two verses after, rejoice in heaven, the dragon has been thrown down. The verse before that, the woman fled into the wilderness to have a place prepared by God where she's nourished. And then the one after it, the woman with wings flies into the wilderness where there's a place where she goes where she's nourished. The one before it, she gives birth to a son, a male child. The one after it, the woman gives birth to a male child. So all I've done here is I've just taken several of the ones that are in the center, showing you the parallels. At the beginning, I just showed you all the ones that are at the ends of the book, chapters 1 and chapter 22. And we're making our way to the center. Sherry, this goes on for over 50 levels.
Wow. Oh, wow. That gives things a whole different perspective on, instead of just reading it linearly and literally, you know, from verse 1 to the end, you know, and then, like you said, trying to match it up to current day events and newspaper headlines of where are we in this continuum, because, you know, there have been a lot of people, they haven't dug down through this at the same level of what you're teaching us here tonight, but I've heard a lot of different pastors and writers and speakers talk about that. You know, the book of Revelation was written, you know, 2,000 years ago, and it wasn't just linearly from then till now, that there was a lot of circular things that have happened along the way. And you're just pointing some of the really deeper levels, and 50 levels, that's amazing, Doug. That's amazing.
It's hard for me to comprehend that that's even possible to do. And they're actually happening within 1 to 2 verses of where they should be happening from the center all the way out to the end. So it's not like you're skipping around in this case and trying to make things work. Like they're actually within 1 or 2 verses of where they should be.
And what version, what translation of the Bible are you using to do these with?
you can deal with any of them. Almost all of them will show you most of them. So,
wow.
You know, you might get a word, something that might be translated a little different in terms of the word. Sometimes it might be the same word in Greek, but the English translation has it as a different word. But you can still tell just from a parallel concept what's going on if you sit down and you start studying it out and reading it.
Fascinating. I mean, it just will give us a whole different world to study that the book of Revelation from.
Yeah. So if you, you know, if people can just grasp this idea, then you can start to see that, okay, maybe if the book is showing itself literarily to be repeating itself on the level of a giant chiasm, and then also structurally to be looking at presenting itself as possibly up to 7 different rings that are all going back to the first part and coming to the end, and then going back to the first part and coming to the end, that this should probably have an effect on the way that we interpret the things that we're seeing in it. And I actually think one of the reasons why Revelation has been so enigmatic and so difficult for people to try and understand is because we're recognizing that there's repetition, but we're not able to categorize it in a logical way. So we're trying to, you know, it's like we're grasping for straws, knowing that there's something that's there. It's kind of like me when 2020 happened and they shut everything down, and there was something in my mind that said something's not right here. And I didn't know what it was, you know, and I had to sit down and I had to do some studying and actually found you a couple places that put all of a sudden it puts into perspective what I wasn't able to make permanent in my mind, have some sort of a thing to fix it to go, okay, I'm not just crazy. I'm not just sensing that there's something wrong. There's something actually that you can use to explain what I'm seeing that gives interpretive power to the times we live in. And that's what I'm trying to help people see with the book of Revelation is, yeah, you can actually make sense of things that are repeating that you feel like there's something going on here, but you're not quite sure what it is.
That's really, really good. And I'm sure that and further into this study and next week's study too, you'll talk about why this is important. I mean, why is it such an important thing to be able to read the book and other books of the Bible the same way?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different things. We won't give too much away for our last episode. But if we think about the different ways that people have approached the book, there's two different kinds of basic ideas. You can read the book as having been fulfilled already long ago in our past. Some people have done that. They call them preterists. There's people who see the book as kind of being fulfilled throughout the last 2,000 years. So most of the time, those people will tag different parts of the book to different epochs of history. And usually they'll say things like, you know, the first 3 chapters were kind of the early church period. The next 3 chapters were kind of the Constantine period. And then they usually come to our point in time where we're like right at the millennium or whatever. And they see it. There's a called historicists. There's other people that read the whole book almost entirely as future. So this is probably the most popular way that people read the book today, that especially starting in chapter 4, all the way to almost the end, if not the very end of the book, they're like, it's all in the future still to us. So it's like, how do you make sense of how we could have so many totally different ways of reading this book, looking at it all these years after the fact? And my thought is, well, if the book is being, if it's a secular book and it's repeating itself, maybe that's exactly what we would expect to find, is that there's some truth to the fact that things have already been fulfilled. There's some truth to the fact that it keeps being fulfilled throughout history because history itself is cyclical. And then there's some truth to the fact that it's going to also be fulfilled in the future because history is cyclical.
There are an awful lot of people that are affiliates for Mike Lindell because we all really appreciate what he does for this country. We appreciate the hard work that he does, and we appreciate his products. He has more than 200 products in his store, everything from pillowcases and comforters to doggy beds.
and to wonderful slippers and bathrobes. There's something for everybody and something for everybody in each age group. I mean, one of the things that I really like a lot are the pillowcases, the children's Bible story pillowcases that I just think are such a great way when you tuck your child into bed at night to use these pillowcases that they come from his store to start to tell the story about Adam and Eve and Noah and the Ark and different things. And they're colorful and they're really pretty. So from children all the way up to your gentlemen that want to have like nice slippers or to your dog, the doggy beds and things are just wonderful. So My Pillow is a great place to shop for just about anything that you want. And if you use our affiliate code DRT, that helps us, that can benefit us, that helps Mike Lindell, and you'll get a great product for anybody that you're shopping for.
Well, welcome back, everybody, for that little quick break that we had here. I'm in the middle of a big thunderstorm here in Ohio, and all the electricity went out. My computer shut down, and Doug didn't know where I went, and suddenly there was no conversation on Telegram or anything like that. So we're pinning this back together from where he left off at the end. We are close to the end of our session yet today, but he wants to have some concluding thoughts of what we were talking about this circular thinking as the way we should read the book of Revelation as literature.
Revelation has been such a tricky book for people to interpret over the course of 2,000 years. And we've had such totally differing opinions that you have some people that have seen it as being fulfilled already, especially in 70 AD. And you have some people seeing it being fulfilled over the course of 2,000 years of history, tagging different parts of the book to each of those chapters. And then you have some people, the majority today, really in conservative evangelicalism, that see the book as being entirely in our future. And it's like, well, why? How can you account for those drastic of differences, you know? And my thought is, well, maybe it's actually coming from the way that the book is written itself, that the literature is actually lending itself to all those different forms of interpretation. And if you're not understanding what you're reading, you could tie any of those in. And that actually kind of makes sense, because if it's a circular book and it's starting from the first, you know, coming of Christ, ending into the second coming, and it keeps doing this over and over, well, then that kind of actually helps us understand that history itself is cyclical, which we all know that it's cyclical. And it's actually having us view history cyclically from different perspectives, as we talked about with that turret analogy. And if that's the case, then if history is like this, then it can actually be repeating itself. And so we could actually see things happening in the first century being fulfilled already, things throughout church history tying into very specific parts of Revelation because history is repeating itself. And then, you know, coming to the end of days, whenever that should be, whether we're living in them or not, you know, whether they're 1,000 years from now or whether we're actually in them, history is repeating itself, but it's getting worse, you know, and more dramatic, which is the very way that the cycles are to be read. I mean, if you are reading through it, there's no question that on a linear reading, you feel like things are going from bad to worse, you know?
Wow. Yes, we do, for sure.
And that's intentional. And but you can do that in a literary way so that you're reading something that for say is talking about the end of days, the very last war, for example. And the first time around, you tell it in a way that's kind of bad. The next time you talk about it, it's worse. And then the next time you talk about it, it's really bad. But then maybe the last time you talk about it, we'll get into this in another talk, you're actually talking about it totally differently. And you talk about it very briefly and you just say, Satan's been defeated, God wins. And but it's all talking about the same sort of a thing, because you're trying to give different ways of looking at the book and different ways of looking at the history of the war or whatever that will work on your mind all in different ways. So I think that that's a good explanation for why we've disagreed on how to interpret the book. But the funny thing is that if I'm right, we can actually all be looking at it in a way that's true and not even necessarily mutually exclusive or contradictory to one another.
Very true. And very exciting and of all the things that you said tonight, which all of them were just fascinating, the thing that
was really interesting to me is how you can read the whole Bible from that perspective, and that there is this whole circular way of reading it. So you just don't feel like it's a dry linear progression from book, chapter, verse, book, chapter, verse, you know, all the way through. But there's a linear way to look at it from a very different, alive and fresh and loving sort of perspective. So I think that's really great. Well, you know, we're almost out of time tonight, Doug. So where can we find this fascinating book? Now that your book is out, where can we find the rings? Oh, excuse me. Where can we find the Rings of Revelation?
Well, so right now the paperback of the main book is out and the hardcover for both books are out. What I've done is I've put together the main book, which is kind of explaining everything that we're going through in much more detail than we can do here in this four-part episode. That's the main book. And then what I've put together is a resource manual that has kind of all the charts and the outlines. I'm not afraid of outlines. They're great. it has many, many Old Testament quotes that are found in Revelation and allusions to it so that you can start to use those to look and see just how much of the Old Testament is appearing in the book of Revelation, which is very important for interpreting the book. You know, charts, pictures, all the things that I've kind of accumulated over the years. I put them in a reference guide.
Oh, wow.
I'm having troubles with Amazon right now with their with the paperback edition for whatever reason. Hopefully we'll get that settled in the next week or two. But you can go on Amazon and order them. You can go to my website, douglasvandorn.com, and there's links to it from there as well.
Well, it bears repeating again, is that all of my authors that I have on that I have conversations with, I always tell people, go to Amazon, read the reviews, read about the book, go to the author's page and buy the book directly from the author. And then
in this case, you don't need to worry about that because I go through Amazon. They're my distributor, so it doesn't matter. I don't get anything more from my page if you go to that or Amazon.
Oh, you don't?
No, I don't.
Well, most people, I tell them, go to the author's page. They get a little bit more, and then go back to Amazon and write a review because that's where
all
the
eyeballs
are. Well,
please write reviews. Yes, I absolutely want a review. Unless it's going to be super terrible, then...
Yeah, don't do the one stars. And so like that. Well, Doug, this has been really delightful. And I can't wait to start with section two next week, where we will start at the same place, the same time. And hopefully we won't have thunderstorms that knock out all of my electricity and have to do that again. But we hope that we patch that up for you, the viewers, so that the experience will be just fine. So next week, same place, same time, we're going to be here on Thursday night with Doug Van Dorn talking about the Rings of Revelation. So with that, I want to close out with one of my favorite verses from the Bible. I close all my podcasts with, whether they are live or pre-recorded, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until the next time, remember to lean into God, trust Him for everything. He will never let you down. So, and all of you premium podcast members, you know, all of the previous four-part series that we did with our previous authors, those are yours to be able to look at for a lifetime of support as long as you're a member. And you can find those by going to drtempany.com and hovering over the podcast tab. So we will be here again next week at the same time. Doug, thank you so much for tonight. And for everybody else, good night and God bless.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.